Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause and keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the donate tab.
So has this question showed up for you? How are you doing? Like, are you grading yourself on how well you're doing on the retreat? Like this inner evaluator of like, I really suck at this part of the retreat, but I'm really awesome at this part of the retreat. Or more often than not, for me, the part that I think I suck at, the inner evaluator that says you suck at this, tends to be around a lot. Has your inner evaluator showed up, or just me? Okay, good. I'm not alone in this experience. You know, they say that this is not another arena for self-judgment, but it happens, doesn't it? So we just see that inner evaluator. What's up? Thanks for giving me this D minus today. Appreciate you. You know, this is my inner evaluator showing up a lot today. This is my first residential retreat teaching. I know this is a lot of y'all's first ever sitting a residential retreat. And there's something so comforting to me that it's like we're both in this together. Like we're all in this together for firsts, you know? That there's a place of discovery, what to expect. And I'm playing that game too. And so my inner evaluator has been showing up. I could tell you all the things he's telling me I suck at. For one, I'll just use a simple example. You know, earlier today, my inner evaluator, which helps me sometimes to motivate me, and I'm working on, you know, talks and meditations and all of that, and I'm telling y'all to remember. Hey, remember the present time experience. Remember the ground. And I walk in here, I forgot my fucking mask. I was like, oh God, I'm telling everybody to remember. I'm forgetting. And this, in that moment, this spinning of the inner evaluator was just, you know, going off about how I'm not cut out for this. And how, you know, forgetful I am, and how y'all are going to notice I forgot my mask and hate me, banish me from the tribe, you know? And, you know, just kept on going and going as that inner evaluator does. And then, okay, yeah, I see you, there you are. And I had a wonderful opportunity to sit as my boy Andrew's given a talk about watching the mind. I'm sitting there watching my mind pummel me with all the ways I fucked up. And okay, there you are, I see you. Okay, I see you, I see you. And then guilt. Oh, it's just guilt. I just made a mistake. And I feel guilty about that. Oh, okay. I can work with that. Guilt. What a reasonable place to land. So what did I do? Well, I went out and got my mask and came back. Problem solved. Cool. Well, that's hard to tell the mind. You know? Nothing to fix. Nothing to control. Nothing to change. Abandoning all hope on a better past. A mistake was made. Nothing to fix, nothing to control. You know, Andrew likes it when I talk about me being a demotivational speaker. I really think I am. Like, I think that's the perfect, like, I would put that on business cards. Because I get hyped up for the Dharma. You know, I'm playing it low because we're on retreat, but y'all know I get excited about this stuff. I'll, you know, jump up and down, move my arms, be yelling about giving up. Let go, give up, abandon all hope on changing the past, renunciate, do less. Okay, it's the motivation to let go, so it's demotivational. And I'm like the anti-Tony Robbins. Confession time again. I like Tony Robbins, but I'm not Tony Robbins. And Tony Robbins says, if you're not growing, you're dying. If you're not growing, you're dying. And I need to hear that sometimes because I'm a slow burner. I'm a B type. So it's good to have, like, if you're not growing, you're dying. It's good to have meaning in life. It's good to have passion in life. It's good to have drive in life. It's good to have desire in life. And at the same time, there's a little bit of confusion in that statement. If you're not growing, you're dying. Well, guess what, Mr. Robbins? You're dying. You can grow, but you're still going to die. You know? So it's this aspect of maybe that first part of the statement may be negating the second part of that statement. That we have to be striving to grow, striving to achieve, striving to accomplish, so we don't have to look at the second part of that statement. You're dying. And even that death may be a loaded, heavy topic, but there is these negation in statements sometimes that we use our own growth and ambition and motivation to actually avoid what is in front of us, calling for our love and attention. And what I talk about is love and attention. We're growing, we're achieving, we're accomplishing, we're doing. You know, talk about that human doing versus human being doing. And all this doing, what's underneath that? And I think it's really just this question. Am I lovable? Am I lovable? If I give a crappy talk tonight, am I still lovable? Will y'all love me? If I don't do a good job at work, well, the people I work with, will they still love me? Am I lovable? And we set up conditions for our love. I'm only lovable unless this happens. And, you know, bringing that reflections, what are your conditions for love? Are you lovable? I just want to answer that question for you. Yes, you are lovable. We may not feel that we're lovable all the time, but you are lovable. You know, sometimes it's like this very childlike dharma. I love this, like, it's just a child that wants love in me, you know? That we can be childlike without being childish. We don't need to be reactive. We don't need to create harm. We can have wisdom, but to know we need to bring in some childlike love into our practice. That Mr. Rogers Dharma. It's you I like. It's not the things you wear. It's not the way you do your hair, but it's you I like. the way you are right now, the way down deep inside you, not the things that hide you, not your toys, they're just beside you, but it's you I like. I've been hanging around with Panyawati too long. She has me singing. I bet y'all never even heard me sing, unless it was like screaming in my band. This dharma that has this sweet melody to it. Mr. Rogers sticks in my head. Panyawati sticks in my head. It's okay. If your mind's singing songs, let it sing songs. Let it be these beautiful songs. So this song gets stuck in my head from time to time. It's you I like. What a beautiful message with it. Because we get confused. Our confused heart, when Andrew talks about training the heart, it gets confused from time to time. We just need to see it. The idea that we feel as if we can hate ourselves into becoming something that we can eventually love. You know, we withhold love, starve the parts of ourselves that we don't like that much. We starve them out, withholding love from them. Maybe they'll die. And this belief that punishment, abandoning, banishment, exiling will lead to some sort of awakening, some sort of happiness. Our heart's confused when it does that. And a lot of confusion, of cycles of confusion, the continuation of confusion. Where I learned this confusion, I know yesterday I was talking about in middle school. And there's like a good like 4 years of my life that I, all the memories I have, especially with male figures in my life, they're just mad at me for some reason. They're just yelling at me for some reason. And that sticks around. That is some residual about that. There's something unlovable about me. They must be mad at me for some reason. Hopefully I can see clearly and eventually have some forgiveness. They were confused. They wanted the best for me, but it turned out in a harmful way. And so the residual of that. I was about a teenager, maybe in my early 20s, watching Scarface. That's a great movie, ain't it? And there's a specific scene in Scarface that he's out having dinner, and he's like coked out, drunk, making a mess, and you know, being violent and all of that. And they kick him out of the restaurant. And as they're hauling him off, he says, "That's right, I'm the bad guy. Y'all motherfuckers think you're good, so I can be the bad guy." So it's like the idea that good and bad are right there. And if we're thinking in terms of good and bad, I'm the bad guy. I just love that. It was something so validating that I found an identity and a connection with Scarface, the bad guy. And I was like, yeah, dude, I get that. And the amount of places I've been kicked out of, you'd be impressed. I've been kicked out of plenty of bars, seriously. Because it's this reactive part that's coming out. This bad guy's coming out. And so if I can't be with that inner bad guy, I'm going to act out in harmful ways. So it's like I have this inner Scarface in me, this inner bad guy in me, and he's coked out, holding an AR-15, just blasting shit left and right. And all he needs is, "Hey, dude, I see you. I care about you. He puts down the AR-15. So I can't wait to hear all the stories that you get on this retreat. So I'm going to give you a retreat story of my own that it must have been like a little over 5 years ago. I went on a retreat. I was really having a hard time with depression at the time, and my depression was activated. And I went on this retreat, and it was a 5-day retreat out in the middle of nowhere, Georgia. And they rented out this place, middle of nowhere, Georgia, and I didn't know anybody there, but I just went. I knew one person, and that person's here, so this person probably knows this story. And I got there, and there was this guy, and he was older than me, and everybody on this retreat was older than me, so I've already felt like the outcast. I had that to lean on to project something about, that these people are older than me and better than me. And so I get there, and the retreat manager there is like the nicest guy. And he shows me around the place where they're having the retreat, and gives me my working meditation and make sure everything's great. And everything about this guy was just so likable. He was like, you know, much older than me. And he was like very handsome, like really handsome. Like, you know, and then had this beautiful head of hair, like this like beautiful silver long hair. And he was like this silver fox and just this handsome, nice guy that was so organized and so pleasant to be around. And I hated his fucking guts for some reason. Just something about him made me feel like shit. Because it was like, I can never be as great as this guy. So in the retreat, we sat in a circle. And of course, right across from me is the silver fox. So anytime I meditated, I look up and it's like, oh gosh, I hate that guy so much. Why do I hate this guy? He's so nice, but oh, and it's like bubbling up of shame and self-ridicule and comparison was arising as the look up at this silver fox that was so much better than me. And day after day of just othering myself, comparing, hating, othering, comparing, hating. And then one day it was raining at the retreat, and we had to do walking meditation inside. And then this place they rented out, I wasn't too happy about it. They had taxidermy on the wall. And so I had to do the walking meditation in a specific spot where there was taxidermy on the wall. And so it was pretty intense. I was doing this walking back and forth. So on one end, I'd be walking, and then there'd be a deer head. And then I'd turn and then face the wall and turn, deer head, face the wall. And then as I was getting closer to this deer head in my walking meditation, I saw there was a plaque underneath this dead deer head. And it said, "Killed by Mike Malley, 1997. And it literally said, "Killed by." And, you know, the rage and the anger and the hate of the Mike. Man, fuck you, Mike. I don't even know who Mike is, but what a dick. And it's just like, that was just like back and forth of this like, oh, not liking the silver fox, not liking this guy Mike. And just back and forth and looking at the deer head and the intensity of this hatred just bubbling up in me, and just having a mindful place to feel and know this hate, this anger, this shame, this self-hatred, this ridicule that was all bubbling up in me until there was a breaking point. I stopped. I looked at the deer. There was 20 minutes left in the walking meditation. I just sat there and started bawling, crying, staring at this deer. Release, pure release. And it felt great that this exile sadness was just hidden in me, serving my depression, serving my anger, serving my hatred. It was just there. And the more I saw the hatred, the more I saw the anger, there was something else there too, sadness. And the sadness, I have no clue why, but what. And the feeling, the throat, the sadness, the choked up feeling in the throat as I looked at this dead deer. The pounding of the heart, the softening of the shoulders, and the release of tingling through the body of sadness. And I just sat there, crying, looking at this deer, the release. And it must have been a pretty intense scene to see. You know, these people that are older than me, just looking. Oof. And at the end of the retreat, we broke silence and sat in a circle and we talked. And I thanked the group because I was like, thank you for being so awesome because I hated y'all. And I knew it wasn't your fault. It was something in me that needed to be named. This hatred that arose in me. There wasn't any place to assign it. It's just hatred. It's just an inclination of the mind. And when I said that, there was an older hippie lady next to me that I was projecting was, you know, awesome and all that, better than me. And she just started crying. She was like, oh, I didn't know you could say that, you know? And normalized her own. She said, yes, I was doing the same thing. And then as we were at the end of retreat, me and her bonded. We had some coffee together. We talked. We were both in recovery. We had a lot to connect on. And it's wonderful that I walk into this place feeling like a weirdo isolating. And I go to hatred and I go to pure connection. And it was awesome. So this is the process we're looking at right now, compassion. Compassion. Because what do we do with these parts of us that are confused? It's like Mara, you know Mara? Has Mara visited you this week? Has Mara came to you? Mara's the, you know, Buddhist equivalent to the devil. It's like this character that we place on our mind states that are like, greed, hatred, ignorance, all those hindrances, the restlessness and the doubt and sloth and torpor. But looking at how Mara shows up and what we do with Mara. I see you, Mara. I know you, Mara. And we just get to see and know Mara because Mara is confused. Mara thinks he's doing the right thing. It's like pain. Pain arises. What do we do with pain? Well, we hate it. Or we cling to pleasure as a way to avoid pain. Or we ignore it altogether. This is Mara's way. It seems to be like the biological way to handle pain. We're set up for survival, not happiness. So if we just go based off our own survival, it's pain arises. I hate that. And so this is where we flip the script a little bit. Hatred's not appeased through hatred. Hatred's appeased through love. And to a certain degree, I think even that quote sounds like a battle between good and bad. Like hatred, bad, love, good. But it's we look at this like aspect of love is a container to hold whatever arises. Nothing to achieve, nothing to accomplish. It's you I like the way you are. Hateful mind. Peace and love to you, hateful mind. It's you I like. And so this love, well, we'll look at that though. Love and hate, that to a certain degree, we have these two minds we look at. We have the volitional mind and the non-volitional mind. We have this mind that just thinks thoughts all on its own, not of your own volition, not of your own efforts. Have you noticed that? The mind just thinks all on its own, right? And some of those thoughts it thinks are kind of wacky. So that's not your fault. It's not your responsibility. Just see and know that mind that just says things all on its own. But then we also notice that we have a mind of volition, we can actually meet our mind with a certain effort. If you notice right now, if I said, think red balloon, what are you thinking of? A red balloon. So you can actually conjure up thoughts as well. So this is where our power is to meet hatred with love. So we train ourselves as the non-volitional hatred just shows up all on its own. We can bring our own volition to meet it with a thought of love. And this is the training over time that the non-volition, or the volition becomes the non-volition. This purposeful type of thinking inclines the mind to be just natural. And so while we look at what love may be, you know, love's a complicated word, and I know we've covered this difficulty from time to time. And so looking at this complication, sometimes it's nice to explore what love could actually mean. And for one end, I like love as connection. I see you. I know you. And just aspect of being seen and known, it's kind of nice. I see you. I know you. So as hatred arises, just have that connection with it. I see you. I know you. And even this word love, like connection as love, like when we hear a song we like, or love, we hear a song we love, we go, I love that song. Why is that? Oh, you have some connection to that song. Has an emotional connection, has some reminder of a moment that was nice. I feel connected with that. And so we take time to be in relationship with some of the more difficult aspects of our internal experience. And so that's a relationship that we learn to know some of these more difficult parts of our internal experience, and then we start to become in relationship with the world. So just like how my relationship sometimes tends to be to isolate and avoid, because I don't feel safe in this world. So as soon as I go, oh, that's something inside, and I develop a relationship with that aspect that is holding me back from being in relationship with the world, it empowers me to be out into the world. And so this also, this aspect of love is very empowering too. So on one end, it's connection, but the other end, it's this empowering security. And as Andrew talked about, the Metta Sutta, the Discourse on Loving Kindness, teaches us how the monks and nuns of the time were, you know, scared of the dark. They're scared of the tree ghosts during their retreat season. And the Buddha said, oh, boundless love and kindness in all directions. Wish them ease. Wish them gentleness. And this power of love and kindness will give us the security to go to the places that may be more difficult, will empower us to do the things that is outside of our comfort zones. And we'll expand this love and kindness outward and unbounded in all directions. So while we have connection, we also have empowering security. So this is our training. We started with the breath, this present time awareness, sati, remember. Remember to come back over and over. And as we come back, we bring a sense of kindness. And we come back to the breath, come back to the body with an attitude of loving kindness. And then we start having some clarity of vision. We see this mind is here. And as we see the mind, we note, oh, aversion. Oh, grasping. Oh, I'm lost in thought. So we note when the mind has greed, hatred, and delusion. And we note when the mind doesn't have greed, hatred, and delusion. And so we expand this even further. So when the mind has greed, hatred, and delusion, we expand this capacity for loving kindness to include pain. So this is what compassion is, karuna. compassion is really just loving kindness towards pain. We develop loving kindness, and then what's the first thing to take it away? Typically pain. On the other end, we need to have appreciative joy for all the pleasures in life. But in this context, we're going to look at pain. Compassion is just the expansion of the heart to include pain. And last night I talked about these two wings, wisdom and compassion. So they are definitely wings that we can look at, and I think through a course cultivation, through a training cultivation, it's good to see these two wings. And at the same time, they are the same thing, that compassion is the wise response to pain. And then we see these near enemies to compassion, which pity is the near enemy of compassion. And I'm a recovering alcoholic, dude. Like, I have used pity hardcore. Like, poor me. I can't do this. I have manipulated and mistreated women many times in my life with this gift of pity. Do this for me. I can't. Poor me. I don't know. I'm a fuck up. Do that for me. I don't know. I'm a fuck up. And until it was like, no, you can do that. You need to do that. You need to do that on your own. You're a big boy now. Go. You know? Be a grown-ass man. I was like, I didn't know I could do that. Everybody in my life pitied me and told me I wasn't good enough. Now it's, you could do this. Go approach that pain. I believe in you. And that's what compassion is. Compassion isn't, oh, poor you, you're suffering. It's, oh, yeah, you're suffering. Great, now do something with that. And I gotta be honest, a certain amount of me in these interviews, hopefully, I'll say it over and over again, I love y'all and support y'all. And it was hard to listen to some of these interviews. Because on one end, we're opening up about the suffering we're experiencing this weekend. And another end is just I have this pure empathy and connection with some, like all of you, really. And I hear that, oh, I'm having a hard time. Like the Dharma dad in me is like, want to hold you and be like, oh, it's okay. Nothing bad will ever happen to you. And I got to stop. Great. I'm glad you're suffering. Sounds so terrible, but I'm glad you're suffering. Because this is what we talk about, the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. If you were just rolling around in the mud, I'd pick you right up out of there. But this is the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And so this statement said to me often, and I say it to you now, that don't squander your suffering. If you have suffered during this retreat and you continue to suffer in this retreat, good news. That's what you're here to do. So suffer well. Get good at your suffering. Because eventually it'll stop. Not to say pain goes away, not to say life becomes all sunshine and rainbows, doesn't mean our hearts don't break. Well, we broke our hearts so hard that it's just wide fucking open now. You know, the ways we break the heart, we can break it closed, shut it down, bury all sorts of hate and addiction and fear and ignorance on top of that heart so we never feel it, or we break the heart open and allow life to live through us through this vast broken heart. So while we sit here in mindfulness, I like to say mindfulness is one insult after another. You get completely insulted as you sit and watch your mind say all these judging things and self-evaluations. Another insult, another sense of suffering. What a wonderful opportunity. So this is the good news of compassion. Don't squander the suffering, because the higher happiness is at the other end. And as we look into how to practice compassion, I'm a more technical person when it comes to these types of meditations. You may not be, but I'm going to teach it as it in like a more technical way, and just see how this shows up for the rest of the evening for you. That we want to have a sense of loving kindness. I like to start with a kind heart, an accepting heart, a caring heart. And so as we develop loving kindness, with whatever level of loving kindness is available, it doesn't have to be what the Metta Sutta says of all this radiating loving kindness, but just a knowing and a willingness to be friendly is important enough for me that I can reflect on the Venerable Panyawati singing to me, or Mr. Rogers, or some of these more lighthearted aspects to go into these places that are difficult. Because sometimes it's like, if we don't have that kind, friendly, gentle heart, it's like we're going into battle with no ammunition. We're going to get our ass kicked. So we want to come in, not that this is a battle, but we want to come into this meditation with a gentle heart. And then as we approach with a gentle heart, we open up to pain. So at first, this can be a little stressful, and it's okay to be a little stressed out. Sometimes we think about meditation, and it's all about bliss and calming. Yes, that's a certain type of meditation, but in compassion meditation, it's okay to have a little bit of stress with it. We don't want to go overboard, but have a little stress. It's okay. Open up to the pain. And when I talk about pain, we have this aspect of pain that we look at different qualities of pain. We have physical pain. And as you sit with physical pain, we can have compassion for physical pain. And where insight comes in with compassion towards physical pain, and I sit with the knee, I have a knee pain, and I have compassion, so I open up to the knee pain and get to know the knee pain and become friendly with the knee pain, and we start to witness what we call pain. That pain is a construct. We made up that word just so we can communicate to one another what a human experience is. And we say, oh, the human experience is painful. Well, what is that? What is this human experience that is painful? Well, pain directly is like a pressure. It may have some like heat to it, and it has edges to it. And then we become curious with pain. Like, oh, what is this pain? And we let go of the resistance and have a curiosity, especially with physical pain. It's really nice to notice that. And then the mind comes in and wants resistance to pain, wants to fight pain, wants to get rid of pain. And then we see the mind's tendencies towards that, and then we come back to curiosity of what actually pain is. It's a movement, it changes, it's pressure, it's edges, it's heat, it's all of those things that are really impossible for me to name because it is a direct experience. I'm still using constructs to describe this direct experience. So have that direct experience for yourself looking at pain. And then we also have emotional pain. And like I said, that some of these things like sadness, I don't know if it's quite painful, but we label it as a negative emotion, which I don't like that because sadness isn't negating anything or bad in any way. It's actually a helpful emotion, but it's felt as unpleasant sometimes. There tends to be a resistance to things like sadness or grief or guilt, any of these things. So where I was talking about, what's the direct experience of sadness? And I was like, oh, yeah, I felt it like in my throat. Really, like that choked up feeling. I was like, oh, choked up. Felt it in my eyes with some crying. Felt it in my chest. And there was like a tingling throughout my body. Oh, I opened up to sadness. That's the direct experience of sadness. So we have physical pain, we have emotional pain, we have mental pain, too. The mind that's agitated. You can open up to your mind that's agitated, too. So just like I was talking about hating that guy, open up to the hatred in the mind of hating somebody. What's hatred like? And a lot of this stuff does come back to physical. What's an agitated mind feel like? And there's like a pressure in the forehead. We become disembodied, more up here in our own little heading world. And then we become embodied and start experiencing things differently. So even as your greed, hatred, delusion, all these things that we think are wrong and bad, open up to those too and see what that's like. What's the direct experience of having compassion for a difficult mind state? And so we want to have kindness and friendliness, and we open up to the pain, whether it's physical, emotional, mental, it's probably all three. We bring care for this pain. I open up to this pain. May I open up to the pain and confusion in my life? May I care for this pain and confusion? And this is this motherly love that comes with compassion, holding this, hold this pain with care. Not a small, but a big holding. When I talk about that mama metta, big mama metta holding the pain. As a mother protects with her life, have compassion for the pain. So I care for this pain. And when that happens, this is the aspect of self-love. I've even done brain scans around this, that this aspect of compassion releases oxytocin. So oxytocin is that hugging neurochemical. As much as I want to hug y'all, and maybe I have to just do some compassion and have the same chemical arise in me. And then we have the last aspect I want to look at in compassion is may I be free from suffering. And this is the aspect that we open up to the pain, we care for the pain, and then we free ourselves from suffering over that pain. And this is ambitious. It may not even happen as you're sitting, but it's nice to have some ambition to know that pain is inevitable, but suffering over it is optional. And this is the freedom we are looking for in Buddhism. If there's a goal, this is the goal. To free ourselves from suffering over this. And so this word freedom, it's a messy word, ain't it? Like in the United States, how ass backwards we get on this word freedom. We want freedom to do whatever we want without consequences. Freedom to overconsume and misuse our resources and destroy. And that's not freedom. Those consequences are waiting right for us. But the freedom from suffering, the freedom to feel whatever arises, a freedom to be with life directly, even as it's unpleasant and heartbreaking. A freedom to be with this in a free-flowing way. That this belongs to being at ease with whatever arises. Being at peace and even with the conflicts. This unconditional aspect of care. That there isn't anything outside of my capacity for love.